Chapter 15, Fred Fletcher, Politician. Anybody who knows the Fletcher family knows that I am not the political part of the family. That was A.J.'s interest. He had backed a number of candidates over the years, including Ralph McDonald, J.M. Broughton, I. Beverly Lake, Harold Cooley, and, of course, Jesse Helms. Except for Jesse, A.J.'s candidates were Democrats, since that was the only viable political party in North Carolina. As one observer suggested, however, they were from the Republican branch of the Democratic Party. For the most part, I was content to do my jobs at the radio station, help where I could on civic activities, and work actively with the Raleigh JCs. It was one of the JC projects that led to my only first-hand experience in politics. First, let me note that I was not really a stranger to politics. I am the son of A.J. Fletcher, a man who got his secretary elected county treasurer. You couldn't be around him most of your life without picking up something about politics. Secondly, I was on the radio, and it is not difficult for anybody who controls a microphone to be on speaking terms with politicians and would-be politicians. However, it had never occurred to me to stand for election until 1946. When the war ended, the people's attentions turned to other things, and one of those was the commissioner form of government that ran Raleigh. The entire city government was in the hands of three full-time officials: the mayor, the commissioner of public works, and the commissioner of public safety. The JCs spearheaded a group called the Committee for the Adoption of City Manager Form of Government. It was sincerely believed, and I think it was true, that this change was necessary if Raleigh was going to become a modern city. History and Raleigh's ability to deal with its growth over the last 40 years has proved that the new form of government worked. As you might imagine, not everyone was in favor of changing Raleigh's government, especially Mayor Graham Andrews, Public Works Commissioner W.B. Barrow, Jr., or Public Safety Commissioner R.C. Powell. It took a lot of hard work by a lot of people to push the change through, and in working on that, I may have gotten caught up in the fever of politics. In any event, when the 50-person list of people who were running for Raleigh's first city council was published, my name was on it. I don't remember having any campaign organization, nor, so far as I know, did any of the other candidates. We all had some posters and asked everybody we knew to vote for us. And at the end of April 1947, the voters marched to the polls and eliminated most of the candidates. When the list of 14 candidates for the runoff was published, my name was on it. I had not campaigned over the radio. Not once did I mention that I wished everybody listening to Tempest Fugit would vote for me. That wouldn't have been fair. However, once the number of candidates was reduced to a reasonable level, we did the only fair thing: offered free radio time to all city council candidates, including myself. I was, of course, somewhat more comfortable with the microphone than some. On May 7, 1947, the voters of Raleigh elected the city's first council, one lady and six men, and happily, I was one of them. The other commissioners were P.D. Snipes, later elected mayor by the board, Ruth Wilson, who, as the only woman in the group, was named secretary for the board, Fred Wheeler, John Danielson, Joe Correll, and Hobson Gaddis. As political campaigns go, it was a quiet one. I don't remember anyone casting aspersions on another candidate or even making any outrageous political promises. There were only two notable things I remember about the election itself. One is that I lost 100 votes between voting day and the time the votes were certified, moving me from 5th to 6th. Some kind or careless soul had transposed two numbers and awarded me nearly 100 votes more than I received. They were duly removed the next day. The second was that, of the 7 council members elected, 5 lived in the Hayes-Barton precinct. Only Fred Wheeler and I lived outside it. Today, representation is distributed a good deal more broadly. There is, in the 1947-48 city report, a posed picture of Raleigh's first city council, looking for all the world like a display in a wax museum. Looking at it, I wonder if we all hadn't just realized the size of the job that we had been elected to. There were good reasons that we had campaigned for a change in city government, and we had pointed them out wherever anybody would listen to us. Now we had to do something about them. That 1947-48 city report indicates that we made a good start. One notable change was that we quit paying city employees in cash. The city went to a check-based accounting system so that we could keep up with expenditures. We also started issuing monthly financial statements and implemented budgetary controls covering the entire city government. As the report notes, there had been a law on the books for several years saying that the city government would do that, but the controls were never put in place. We established a purchasing division and required that all purchases be made on a bid basis. So, and I quote, "Purchases are no longer made upon a basis of political favoritism or personality preferences." We doubled the rent on the Devereaux Meadow and prohibited private sales of city property. We also added Raleigh's first full-time planning and zoning engineer. To people who didn't know Raleigh in the 1940s, it may sound strange that we paid our city employees in cash or had a system that did not prevent purchases to be made on the basis of political favoritism. But in those days, city government was not only less sophisticated, it was much smaller. The entire city government of Raleigh, including police, fire, parks, garbage, and all the other services it provided, cost less than $2 million a year, and the total revenues of the city were just over $2 million a year. Today, there are suburban churches with bigger budgets than Raleigh had in 1947. It was a busy 2 years, and a lot of changes were made. For a while, when my picture was in the paper, I was identified as City Councilman Fred Fletcher, rather than Raleigh Radioman Fred Fletcher. Occasionally, my two careers would collide. Sometimes it was as simple as a child calling and asking me to name the other council members so that he or she could write a report. At least once, it caused a bigger flap. In 1947, the Raleigh Police Department needed overhauling. Not only were a number of the policemen too old for active duty, but others qualified for medical disability or had had a disabling condition when hired. There was, I discovered, a man who had been with the force for 21 years and had never been promoted. There were a number of policemen who had been hired without the benefit of any kind of examination, physical or mental. As a citizen and a city councilman, I thought something should be done about it. What really caused the flap, though, was that I said something about it in my capacity as a radio announcer and, naturally enough, on the radio. According to the newspaper, I said that the reorganization would result in removing at least 50 of the department's members. That was a pretty bold statement, since the Raleigh Police Department only had about 60 members at the time. I also made it clear that the opinions I was expressing were my own and not those of the council. There was still a good deal of discussion, not so much about the state of the police department, but about whether I should have talked about it on the air. I still think it was a good idea. The condition of the police department was a problem not only for the department, but for the citizens that it was protecting. In any event, the police department was reorganized that year, new training programs were initiated, and it was on its way to becoming a professional force. At the end of 2 years, the term was over, and I decided that if Raleigh could stand me for a second term, I could stand it, so I stood for re-election. And this time, I even ran an ad. That may have been the problem. The ad was long and skinny and had my picture at the top. The headline was very straightforward, "Fred Fletcher wants your vote." Then I did what I had been doing on the radio for years, told the people exactly what I was thinking. After thanking the people for their support on the previous Monday, I wrote, "I really would like to go back on the council for another term. It took us a right smart time to learn what it was all about, and I don't claim to know it all now, but I feel that as a result of 2 years' experience, I am now better qualified to serve than when I was first elected." All of that was, of course, absolutely true. All seven of us had been new to city council work when we were elected. All seven of us had worked hard and learned a lot about the workings of the city. I, however, made a point of the fact that we were learning in my campaign ad. The only campaign promise that I made in the ad was that I would continue working at the job to assist in demonstrating that the new form of government the voters of Raleigh adopted some time ago can and will continue to function in the solution of the above-stated problems, unselfishly and in the best interest of our beloved city. Looking back on it, I can see that this wasn't the kind of promise that made the voters' eyes glow. When they went back to the polls for the runoff, I was not one of the candidates they chose. I guess I was disappointed, but not much. Working on the council is a tough and demanding job, and over the years, a lot of good men and women have given thousands of hours to their city government. And then when they got home at night, they had phone calls from their constituents wanting them to do something else. There was, for me, a bonus in losing. I had had to leave the Parks and Recreation Commission when I became a councilman. When I ceased to be a councilman, I was free to go back to work on Parks and Recreation, a job that became a lifelong love. Chapter 16, Radio with Pictures. It seems that when circumstances become comfortable, something has to come along to stir them up again. By the early 50s, WRAL had become a substantial radio property. We had the AM and FM frequencies. We anchored the Tobacco Network, and we had respectable audiences for our sports programming. Then, along came television. Actually, television had been around for years. When AJ, Mother, and I went to the World's Fair in Chicago in 1934, after I graduated from George Williams College, we visited the RCA exhibit, and I think I was on television for the first time. Then, in 1939, I read where some people at CBS had broadcast one of Columbia University's baseball games. But it wasn't until the early 50s that television became a factor in the Raleigh market. A license was granted to WTVD in Durham, and people in the Raleigh-Durham area began to buy television sets. I remember Dick Mason calling me one day and asking what we were going to do about this television thing. I told him I didn't know. Television was for people with a lot of money, and looking at the resources we had with the radio stations, we didn't have that kind of money. At that moment, I probably thought that we would stick to radio and let somebody else have the television. That's not, however, the way it worked. To give credit where it is due, WPTF had done a lot of preliminary work to get a VHF channel assigned to the Raleigh area. This is the first step in the long process of gaining the FCC's permission to broadcast over the public's airwaves. However, this first step simply sets aside a frequency that will be awarded in a particular area. If more than one applicant wants it, a hearing judge decides who gets it. AJ decided that we would compete with WPTF for it. This represented a real commitment of money and time because we not only had to spend time at the hearings, 9 weeks as it turned out, but we had to spend at least that much time preparing for them, doing research, gathering affidavits, and putting together exhibits. And suddenly we were back to the David and Goliath relationship with WPTF. With the exception of the work being done by our Washington attorneys, my brother Frank and his firm, we did most of the research and writing ourselves, while we did our regular jobs at the station. The finished presentation was 14 large volumes tracing the history of Capital Broadcasting, WRAL, and the Tobacco Network, and outlining the proposed television programming. We had charts and graphs and words, a lot of words. Much of the presentation of WRAL Radio had to do with Tempest Fugit, our sports coverage, and our community activities. The words were mostly written by a young man named Scott Summers, who had been hired to help put the presentation together. Scott, a newsman, would write the copy, and we would send it up to our Washington lawyers for approval. Inevitably, Scott's copy would come back sprinkled with commas, which he, with a lot of muttering and fuming, would put into the final draft. We didn't realize the depth of his frustration until Vincent Welch, our co-counsel, came to Raleigh for a meeting. Sometime during the day, we had the opportunity to introduce Welch to Scott. On finding out who our guest was, Scott stuck out his hand and his jaw and said, "Pleased to meet you, you comma-loving son of a bitch." Then he turned and went back to his writing. WPTF, on the other hand, had hired some specialists to help them put their presentation together. We heard, in a roundabout way, that at least one of their specialists would be glad to let us know what was going on in the WPTF camp. We said, no thank you, we had just as soon not know. The hearing was convened in April of 1954. The WPTF delegation was rather nicely situated at the Willard Hotel in downtown Washington. The WRAL group was comfortably but not so elegantly installed at the Hunter Lodge Motel, about 13 miles south of Washington. AJ and I shared a room, and he complained about my snoring. There was, I suppose, some justice in that, since he used to scare me silly in the middle of the night when he rattled the walls with his snores. We managed to accommodate each other since we wanted to save the price of the room. Food wasn't a problem since we were so nervous that we couldn't eat much anyway. I lived for most of those 9 weeks on cream of wheat and poached eggs. I'm not sure that my stomach would have handled anything more substantial. It was obvious from the start that WPTF was taking our challenge seriously. When we had applied for the radio license, they had made a half-hearted effort to convince the FCC that one station was enough for a market the size of Raleigh. But it didn't seem to bother them that we were granted a license. This was different. Like WRAL, WPTF had a Washington firm that usually represented their interests before the FCC. However, they decided that for this hearing, they needed bigger guns. In addition to their usual firm, they retained General Kenneth Royal. Royal was well known around Washington, not only for his legal work, but as Secretary of War under President Eisenhower. From the very beginning, it looked like Royal wanted to give the WPTF group their money's worth. We didn't even get to the hearing before he started acting like a general. The first instance was in a pre-hearing meeting with the examiner. The hearing examiner, envisioning a long and involved procedure, asked the opponents to stipulate certain facts that he considered obvious. One of these was the financial ability of both parties to properly operate a television station if awarded the license. We readily agreed. The general didn't. Nobody is going to tell me how to try my case, he said. My brother, Frank, who was, as I've mentioned, our Washington attorney, wasn't intimidated by the general. He smiled and noted that the general's statement was spoken like a true general. It was, I suppose, an innocent enough statement, but General Royal felt called upon to explain to us all that he had been that way even before he became a general, which was, Frank observed, probably how he became a general. Later in the hearing, Royal gave us another bit of his philosophy when he told the examiner that he would agree with nothing that he had not first proposed. So much for friendly competition and cooperation. It's just as well, because it wouldn't have lasted long once the hearing got underway. An FCC hearing is one part fact, as presented in the hearing documents, one part defending those facts, and one part shooting down the other side's facts. Those parts are not necessarily equal. Actually, once the hearing starts, the facts themselves seem to be no more than a background for the lawyer's maneuvers. Our lawyers, for instance, learned that the examiner was a second lieutenant in the war. They assumed that, as a civilian caught up in the military in wartime, he might have some residual resentments about the officers over him. And when you are a second lieutenant, all the officers are over you. So the lawyers told us that we should always refer to Kenneth Royal as General Royal. For 9 weeks, we never let anyone forget that General Royal was a general. One of their strategies seemed to be to make me look dumb. Scott had written in a part of the representation that gathering news in a local market was not a matter of legerdemain. Someone at the WPTF table suggested to General Royal that he ask me to explain what that meant, expecting, I suppose, to trip me up on legerdemain. What they evidently didn't know was that there was nobody in Raleigh who was more aware of the manpower, sweat, and planning that went into a good news operation. I had been working on it for years and could assure them that it wasn't magic, it was hard work. Then General Royal asked me if it were true that I had broadcast the location of speed traps on Tempest Fugit. I acknowledged that I had at every opportunity. He was making a big issue of this characteristic of lawlessness when the hearing examiner muttered that it sounded like a good idea to him. They dropped that point. They also jumped on me about WRAL carrying beer advertising. At that time, WPTF did not. That point sailed out the window, too, when someone brought the Examiner a package wrapped in brown paper. Someone, evidently hoping to be funny, asked the Examiner if that was his booze. He smiled and said that he wished it were, but unfortunately it was his laundry. It was obvious they were not going to make a lot of points with our beer advertising. Things seemed to be going well for us, so well, in fact, that I became comfortable on the witness stand. I had started out sitting straight up, almost at attention. By now, I was in about the same posture I used to watch television at home. Every time they charged at me, it seemed that the facts and the Examiner were on my side. And that was, so far as I was concerned, exactly the way it should be. One of our attorneys, Vinnie Welch, disagreed. We were walking out to the hall one afternoon when he pushed me around the corner, grabbed my jacket, and stuck his face right in my face. "Listen, USOB," he said, "when you get back in there, you look scared. You sit right on the front of your seat. You take your time to answer the questions, and you look scared." When we went back in, I did just as I was told. General Royal and the opposition didn't scare me that much, but I had a healthy regard for what my own lawyer might do to me. For 9 weeks, it was a day and night operation. We would be in the hearing room all day. Then we would return to the lawyers' offices and work on the next day's testimony. Literally thousands of man-hours were expended on attacking and defending the most minute of points. When the Examiner rendered his opinion and the TV grant was awarded to WRAL in 1956, the decision was based on two things: what the Examiner called a reasonable distribution of media and the integration of ownership and management. That simply meant that, since we had a 250-watt station and WPTF had a 50,000-watt station, we would be more nearly equal if we were awarded the TV grant, and that at WRAL, the owners and the managers were one and the same. WPTF was, and is, owned by Durham Life, and the owners would have no real part in managing the station. It was as simple as that, and as complicated and as exhausting as that. But it put us into television. 17 years after going into radio, I had a whole new career. Chapter 17, And Now That You Have It. Like so many things, when you pursue something like the television grant and win, you are faced with a major question. Now that you have it, what are you going to do with it? It was not a question that we hadn't given a lot of time to before the FCC decision came down. However, there is a difference between planning something and actually doing it. Television is much more complicated than radio. Just consider the people involved. When I went on the air with Tempest Fugit, there was just me, the turntable, the continuity, and the audience. In those days of 78 RPM records, I got very adept at 2.5-minute bathroom breaks. Spin the record and run, then be back by the time the record had finished. The audience never knew that I had left them. That same program on television, on the other hand, required about 30 people. In addition to the performers, we had the cameraman and the floor manager in the studio with us. There was the director, the audio man, and the technical director in the booth. There were makeup people, prop people, and at least one person to make sure that the people who were in front of the camera knew what they were supposed to do. And, of course, the people who had hair had to comb their hair. It wasn't a matter of grabbing a cup of coffee on the way into the studio and visiting with the audience for 2.5 hours. As you might have guessed, I enjoyed radio a lot more than television. But we had some fun on television, too, and we managed to do some good things for the community. When we went on the air in December 1956, a lot of the people at WRAL-TV were familiar names and faces at WRAL Radio. Ray Reeve, recently elected North Carolina Sportscaster of the Year, was in charge of sports. Scotty Stevenson, who had been my assistant at the radio station, moved with me to the television operation. Paul Montgomery was variously Uncle Paul of Kitty Show fame, or Paul Montgomery, consummate musician, according to what time of day it was. Virgil Duncan moved over from chief engineer for the radio station to chief engineer for the television station. And there were others. George Hall, our program director, David Witherspoon, director of promotion and public relations, and Bill Armstrong, our news director and anchorman. I'm not sure that the word anchorman had been coined at the time, since the anchorman is the one that anchors all of the reports from the field reporters. Stations didn't have a lot of use for one, since they had very few field reporters in 1956. In fact, in 1958, our news staff consisted of the news director, Bill Armstrong, the sports director, Ray Reeve, a photographer, Owen Balance, and the department secretary, Dorothy Buffalo. There were new people, too. One that I remember well is Helen Rogers. Helen was the station receptionist and a cheerful, conscientious, and efficient one. The fact that Helen was legally blind didn't keep her from knowing where everybody was or acting as the communications point for letting the station people know what kind of mood Fred is in. While we are on the subject of Helen, there is one story that sticks in my mind. One day the phone rang, and when Helen answered with her usual cheerful WRAL Channel 5, the caller began making obscene remarks. Now, Helen was a very pretty young lady, very petite and demure, but she took just a few sentences of what the jerk on the other end of the phone was saying and let go with a string of profanity that would have done any sailor proud. When she stopped for a breath, there was a pause on the other end of the line, and the caller said rather shakily, "And the same to you, lady." There were other new faces. Herb Marks, a transplant from Tennessee and Pennsylvania, was Cap'n Five, the host of the Popeye Club. Joanne Federspiel, a native of South Carolina and a former school teacher, was the first of our romper room teachers. And Bob Knapp came down from Richmond right after the station opened to do sports and weather, or what the copywriter of an early brochure unconscionably called his breezy weather shows. My own position was vice president and general manager. When the station went on the air on December 18, 1956, A.J. promised the people of the viewing area that WRAL was going to provide the best television facilities that money could buy. We were also going to provide a voice that will give all sides to those questions which affect the economic, spiritual, educational, and political life of our people. There will be no slanting of the news, no editorials in the headlines. Information to which the public is entitled will be given without bias or favor. I think that, by and large, we accomplished that. Any station that can have Jesse Helms and me working side by side has to provide a breadth of opinion. We also supported a lot of good causes. I think we started the cerebral palsy telethon. We have them all over the country now, but I believe ours was first. We also had a telethon to raise money for lights at Carter Finley Stadium. Movie star Chill Wills came in to help us, and Peter Jennings of ABC News let us put him in the seat of the baseball dunking machine. We did a similar telethon for Shaw University to help them solve the financial problems they were having at the time. And we did one to send the Cary High School Band to Mason City, Iowa for the premiere of The Music Man. Back in those days, we were able to give airtime to events that would never be aired today. For instance, we made and aired a film on horse shows for kids. The year Broughton played and won the state football championship, we carried the game. We even broadcast a Little League championship game at Lions Park. During that broadcast, I got a call from a puzzled viewer in Rocky Mount wanting to know if there was something wrong with the station signal or his set. "All the players look like kids," he said. I assured him that they were kids and he should not adjust his set. But unlike our history in radio, we didn't really make a dent in college sports. One reason was that some sports, like football, were beyond our resources. On radio, you sent an announcer, a color man, and an engineer to cover the football game. If they could get a clear phone line, you were set. On television, you couldn't cover a football game with anything less than an army. Another reason was that people like Chesley Productions were already there. They would sign up stations all over the region to carry their broadcast, so they could make a more generous arrangement for the rights to broadcast the games. One unusual problem that we ran into was UNC televising its basketball games over the school station. That cut into our radio audiences, and since the station was a public TV station, WRAL and other commercial stations thought that it was unfair competition. An amicable settlement was reached when UNC agreed to broadcast the picture only, leaving the audio to the radio stations. That was called Broadvision, and this may be the only time it was used for sports, and I'm not sure it was ever used for anything else. Our efforts worked pretty well. By July 1958, a year and a half after sign-on, we were able to claim that we had led in every Raleigh-Durham ARB survey, sign-on to sign-off. Translated, that means that Arbitron, the people who count people watching television, counted more people watching WRAL between 6 a.m. and midnight than they counted watching WTVD. In television, people treat the ratings, ARB and Nielsen, a lot like the scriptures. I don't mean that they necessarily accept the ratings as truth, but they do quote just the ones that serve their purpose. Within a few months after we went on the air, I moved Tuning In with Fletcher from radio to television. Later, we did a TV version of Tempus Fugit. It was the same kind of thing, some music, some cutting up, some commercials. It was just more complicated. For instance, there's a picture of David Witherspoon, Shelton Lewis, Paul Montgomery, and I doing a barbershop quartet bit on Tuning In with Fletcher. We have on straw boaters and some of the phoniest-looking mustaches you've ever seen. Paul's appears to be insecurely hooked to his nose. On radio, at least on Tempus Fugit, I could have created the same boaters and mustaches just by saying we had them, much the same way I created the little pigs and the wolf. The shows were popular enough. Most of the time, we led in our time slot. But I'm still proud of the fact that as many people recognize my voice from radio as they do my face from television. Like my job on radio, however, my job on television had its management responsibilities. One of them, so far as I was concerned, was having good people heading up the different departments and letting them do their job. People like George Hall in programming, Bernie Whitaker in local sales, and Fletcher Turner in national sales. And, of course, Virgil Duncan as head engineer. Virgil never had to worry about me interfering with his job, since he was probably the only person in the station who understood his job. He also could spend more money than anybody else, because new television equipment was coming out as fast as you could sign the contracts for what immediately became old television equipment. In addition to supervising, rather loosely, the department heads, I was responsible for network relations. In the beginning, we carried shows from NBC and ABC. Durham carried CBS and ABC. That meant we divided up the better ABC shows. I think we got Maverick and Marcus Welby. I don't remember what they got. Later, Bob Coe of ABC talked me into carrying the full ABC schedule, something that has had its ups and downs over the years. That, however, would have been true no matter which of the three networks we had affiliated with. One of the less bothersome responsibilities of being a network affiliate is going to the network meetings. They always treated us royally at the meetings, giving us a lot of good food along with the bad news. They would also trot out their stars from shows for the coming season to impress us. One year, for instance, Lawrence Welk and his orchestra played for the show. Mr. Welk, probably as good a showman as I have ever seen, had the audience making his champagne bubbles by blowing the little soap bubbles. There we were, a room full of station executives, most of us middle-aged or older, busy blowing bubbles while Mr. Welk bounced around the room. When he got to me, he admired the quantity and or quality of the bubbles that I was blowing and pointed them out to the group. "Ah," he said, "there's a good one." By the time I got back to Raleigh, the word was already here that Fred could always get a job as a bubble blower. The station meetings were not all play, however, especially if you were an ABC affiliate in the 60s. As a network, ABC was often dead last in the ratings. When you consider that stations base their advertising rates on the audience ratings, And the most expensive times the station has are during prime time network programming. You can see why ratings was a constant subject of discussion at the meetings, or more specifically, what the network was going to do to improve the ratings. I remember one particular meeting when the network people were not being particularly cooperative. One station representative after another stood up and asked the network representatives a question. After every question, the answer was no, or not at this time. It appeared that we were not going to get any of the things we were asking for. Finally, I got tired of all the no's and decided to ask a question of my own. I just asked if we were still invited to the banquet that night. I believe that he almost said no out of sheer habit. It did serve to break the tension for a few minutes. It was during my television days that I became active in attempting to transform the North Carolina Association of Broadcasters from a social society to a real professional association. I was not alone in this effort, but I was certainly one of the loudest. For years, we had had our annual meetings, usually at a very nice resort. We played some golf, we ate well, we swapped stories, and we went home. The next year, we did the same thing, except at a different resort. Then, each fall, we met in Asheville. It was no secret to anybody in the NCAB that broadcasting was big business and that it was becoming increasingly complex. In fact, the biggest broadcasting people in the state had essentially run the association for years. There was Dick Mason of WPTF, Harold Essex from Winston-Salem, Charlie Crutchfield from Charlotte, Don Elias from Asheville, and Frank Jarman from Durham. I suppose the difference between their view of the association and ours was that they didn't feel any great need for education or support from the association. They had assets of their own to fall back on. Some of us felt that the NCAB could be a help to all of the member broadcasters, especially some of the smaller stations. In 1963, I ran for president, as much as anyone actually runs for an association presidency, and I would like to say that it was my personal magnetism and force of logic that caused the association to elect me by a large margin. However, to be more truthful, it was the fact that my only opponent withdrew the day before the election. Harry Severance was another of the activists and was one of my best friends in the association. He dropped out and I was elected. Harry was elected president of the NCAB the next year. During my administration, then during his, we began to build the educational side of the association. We had legal clinics, seminars on selling advertising, sessions with business consultants. We put together groups to work on legislation that affected the broadcasters. We still went to great places like Bermuda, and we still played golf, but we also acted like a real industry organization. One of my fondest memories of the NCAB, however, has nothing to do with professionalism, broadcasting, or anything else of a serious nature. It occurred one night when Harry Severance and his wife and Margie and I were strolling down a street in Kingston, Jamaica. Harry and I were walking together while our wives dawdled along in back when two ladies of easy virtue accosted us. That in itself is neither unusual or amusing. However, just as one of them started to make her presentation, our wives walked up. The look of sheer disgust on the face of the prostitute as she stopped in mid-sales pitch was funny. "Ah, forget it," she said and stomped off. I was in radio for 16 years, and I was in television for 20. I enjoyed them both. But if a bunch of us old folks get together at a broadcaster's meeting and start telling war stories, you can almost bet that the stories will be about radio. Those were, as they say, the days. Chapter 18, A Man of Many Parts and One Park. Like anybody who lives 80 years, I have some things that I am not too proud of, some things I'm moderately proud of, and a few that I am inordinately proud of. One of the things in the last group is a little patch of green land on Glenwood Avenue, not too far from my house. As I drive down Glenwood going downtown, I pass the sign that declares that this is Fred Fletcher Park. I'm proud that the folks I've worked with for nearly 50 years thought enough of me to name a park after me. Some people might get a building named after them or their picture hung in some public place. I'd rather be remembered by a park any day. Any reader who began at the front of this book and has gotten this far has probably noticed that I had a greater than average interest in recreation. I still have. When I went to George Williams, a part of my studies and a large part of my YMCA responsibilities had to do with recreation. When I came back with Margie and enrolled at UNC, I got a part-time job with the university PE department. At the same time, Margie, with her degree from the University of Illinois in PE, had a job with the WPA establishing and assisting recreation programs in nearly a dozen counties around the Durham-Orange-Wake County area. She covered her territory in a Model A. Looking back on it, I suppose it was daring for a woman to be motoring over a large part of eastern North Carolina by herself. But Margie was always capable and independent. We didn't think much about it at the time. Her job, in case anyone is interested in the workings of this part of the New Deal's WPA, was to assist local people in building an active recreation program. The program also helped them build or improve their ball fields, build swimming pools, and create basketball courts. At the same time, Margie and I became good friends with Harold Myers and his wife. Dr. Myers was the professor of recreation in the sociology department at the university and regional director of the WPA. We spent a lot of time talking about what could and should be done in recreation. Over in Durham, John Moorhead was doing it. He was responsible for acquiring a lot of land for parks and recreation in Durham. I had the opportunity to meet Mr. Moorhead, and I was impressed both with him and with what he was doing. I wanted to do the same kind of thing for my community. At that point, working on my master's at UNC and being supported by Margie, I still wanted to be a YMCA secretary. The position opened up in Raleigh, and I applied. Wyatt Taylor beat me out of the job. I was disappointed, but as he and I both continued to work in Raleigh, I began to see the wisdom of the group that hired him instead of me. In his tenure as YMCA secretary, Wyatt accomplished a lot. He raised money. He was responsible for building several camps, including Camp Seagull, and he represented the YMCA in the community very well. At the same time, I had gone into radio, was doing something I enjoyed tremendously, and was still able to be involved with recreation, even if the level I was involved at was more budgets and meetings than balls and bats. But at that, I was probably, at least indirectly, involved with more people having good times than I could have been in any other position. And there was probably no other way I would have gotten my picture in the newspaper in a bathing suit. To its everlasting credit, Raleigh was into parks and recreation long before it became a big city. Without pushing the point too far, you could say that the first parks were a part of the original city design. In 1792, when William Christmas laid out the beginnings of Raleigh, he included the Capitol Square and four-acre squares around it. These squares, Caswell, Nash, Burke, and Moore, were to be open green areas. Mr. Christmas was a rather far-sighted fellow, standing there in a grove of oaks and foreseeing a city crowded enough to need green and open spaces. End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.